Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are here with the one and only Mrs. Foley's baby boy, Mick Foley, who's coming to the DC Improv Thursday, April 12th. Mick, thanks so much for joining us. This is an honor.
Hey, it's a pleasure. Did a couple shows at the Improv a few years ago. Had a great time, and looking forward to returning for this tour.
Oh, we are. If you're looking forward to it, we are really looking forward to it. Now, this tour, it's really a special one. This is, you're calling it the 20 Years of Hell tour, which obviously commemorating that warm summer's night in the igloo, 1998, Hell in the Cell with Undertaker. Now, I definitely want to get into that since that's what you're calling it, but. Take me into the build-up. So many people remember that match, but I feel like not many people, so many forget that you had an ongoing program with Taker with the Boiler Room Brawl and the Buried Alive with the little carry hand sneaking up out of the grave. And take me sort of into how you and Taker had already built a psychology together for these, I don't want to call them gimmick matches, but you know what I mean, for these off-the-wall matches.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things I plan to do with this show is really take people behind the scenes and show what I would call, like, you know, the evolution, the execution, the aftermath and legacy of this one really infamous night. Like, I had no idea how important that night was going to turn out to be. And as far as the build up to this match, it struck me as an odd choice for me and Taker, because we had kind of been all over the country and the world in 96 and 97, and it was almost like thrown together. Like, I was like, really, you want me in like a semi-main event, Austin and Kane and the other one? And so it didn't seem to have a ton of build to it. Didn't seem to be the great choice. But we had that chemistry, and that night, you know, kind of fate was either with us or against us. You know, it led to a series of really bizarre, surreal circumstances, and the fact that we kind of lived through it made that night take on a life of its own.
Absolutely. So, in sort of the immediate build up to it, the I know Shawn and Taker had done the original Hell in the Cell, and I think it still might, that was one of Taker's favorite matches ever. And Kane came out, all that stuff. But so with that being the bar, such a high bar set, are you and Taker's, you know, thinking, hey, we have to top this? Is that why you guys went for that first bump? Because the first one was planned and the second one wasn't. But I want to go into the first one.
Yeah, I hate to say planned, but. It was thought of. I watched the first one with Terry Funk, and it was just an amazing match. And I was not like an incredibly gifted athlete. You know, I was not a great climber, not a great pull up guy. Like, all the things you need to really excel in that type of match were not my strengths. And I just said, "What the heck am I going to do?" And then Terry said, "I think you ought to start the match on top of the cell." And we just started like brainstorming with these ludicrous ideas, and we're laughing about how impossible they all sounded. And then I just turned to him and I said, "I think I could do it."
Yeah.
And so we just had this really, you know, a way of starting a match that had never been done. And, yeah, the bottom fell out on us, literally, you know, the top fell out of us.
Yeah.
But that first one, you know, I mean, the idea of starting a match that appears to end in 10 seconds.
how important was the Jim Ross call there? You know, as God is my witness, he's broken in half. And then beyond that, the goose, to me, everyone remembers that. That's the highlight. But to me, the real goosebump part was you on the stretcher and, oh, my God, he's going back up.
Yeah, when I got off that stretcher, you know, and first of all, we didn't know, you know, Jim didn't know what was going down in the match, so he was calling it from the heart. I had no idea what he had said. I remember when I got home from that tour, just laying in bed and watching it over and over. Like, I just could not believe what had taken place, and also that immortal call, you know. With God as my witness, he's been broken in half. Like, I think, you know, if it wasn't for, like, you know, a certain, you know, a certain little bias among, you know, purists in the sporting world, like that would be one of the acknowledged as one of the greatest calls of all time. And I think it already is.
Probably the greatest, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, even when like a soccer game is 6-1, you know, they'll have Jim Ross come, somebody stop the damn match. You know, it's just become part of pop culture, yeah. And you know, and the match has as well. So it's hard to imagine that match with a different call. It just would not have been the same.
Now, that second bump, obviously, that one kind of took you guys by surprise, and the cage broke away, in case some of our listeners don't know. And you went through the top, slammed the mat, chair hit you, knocked your tooth through your nose. How long were you actually out? When do you remember regaining consciousness, you know, noticing the gash and all of that?
Yeah, I think the count, I'll have to go back before I actually hit the stage. DC's my second show, so I'll make all my mistakes in Rosemont.
Thank
and
you.
And we'll have it down.
nice cheap plug, you know, in the other direction.
yeah. I mean, I'm working hard on this thing. I'm writing away, and you see sometimes what works and what doesn't. But one thing I'll do is I'll watch the match, and I'll count. I think it was 42 seconds that I was unconscious, and that to me is like the kind of the irony of professional wrestling, you know, that's considered like, it's that's the fake sport and all that. Like, I'll grant you, you know, certain things about it, but tell me one of your real sports that continues when one of the participants is no longer conscious. You know, like, you don't take a timeout. You try to buy time. And, of course, that would not be the case now. We've learned so much about concussions that match would have been called, you know, at that moment, boom, done. But if it had been that way, clearly I wouldn't be doing this tour talking about that. But the fact that we continued is kind of what added to its allure.
And I'm just amazed by it at the end of it, though, just how you're able not only to finish with the thumbtacks and everything, but my little part that maybe a lot of fans, mainstream fans, don't realize is after he hits the tombstone on you, you do a little mini kick out like you're still just trying to get out. You know what I mean? Like, it's those little things that tell the story.
Kicked my right leg. Like, I was still trying. And I mean, legend has it, the fans gave me a standing ovation afterwards. I would go back. It was a smattering of polite applause. Like, it seemed to just grow in the days and weeks and months and years, and to this point, even decades, to the point where it's just amazing. There was no, the internet was kind of in its infancy, you know, nobody was texting or tweeting links to each other. So it took a while to grow in stature. And so now I do appearances, and it's just stunning to me that about 50% of the people who talked to me about that match weren't even alive when it took place.
That's insane.
Yeah.
But so after that match, I mean, you'd already put in your time and years in the business, but after that and all those hellacious bumps, I mean, I think you were on track to win the title. But I think it happened later in that December on Raw. But take me into that night. I know it was you and Rock. You had DX and the Corporation, all that out there. And everyone talks about that huge Austin pop when he comes out to, you know, lay the Rock out with the chair. But partly it was because Stone Cold was white hot. But at the same time, don't you think it was so many of the fans were finally happy to see you win it? I think that's part of the eruption, you know? A, Stone Cold's coming out, but B, this means Foley might finally do it.
You're trying to put a very polite twist.
Trying to give you credit, man.
And there's no better way than to make a surprise entrance than by having your entrance music hit, you know? I'm going to come out, hit my music. It didn't seem to matter. Those details didn't seem to matter. It was enormous. Yeah, I think there was the realization, like, this might really happen. Vince McMahon had really stacked the deck against me. The Rock was his guy. You know, we're sort of, ring was surrounded. It was a lumberjack match. DX had kind of taken me under their wing as kind of an unofficial member. And it was just like all the stars were in alignment that day. And, I won with Steve's help, and the response was just, you know, it was incredible. And then everything that happened after the three count was all ad lib. Yeah. You know,
Michael Cole and sleeping on the floors of Motel Sixes.
You know, Michael Cole gave a great call. Yeah. You know, I think that's one of the underrated things, and he worked really hard on it, and he was, he was as big a part of that night as JR was of, well, all right, okay, maybe not quite as big. It's right. Almost sacrilege.
Right, right, right.
But Michael was great on that call, and it was something he was really proud of, and I was, you know, really happy to have him there for it.
Absolutely. Talk about how that sort of turned the tide in the Monday Night Wars. I know I've seen you do interviews before where the WCW announcer said, because you guys were pre-taping Raw at that point, and he said, that'll really put butts in the seats, and it really did. It kind of backfired, and you guys won the
race. Big time on them, and it's nice that, you know, Eric Bischoff and Tony Schiavone will admit, okay, we may have, you know, misfired on that one. Actually, I was just on a show with Eric a couple nights ago, and they were like, you guys are gonna be in the ring together, just kind of, you know, come up with a little something. So I, you know, made like I was gonna make a big problem. Let me tell you something, Bischoff, when you gave away, you know, the announcement, you whispered in Schiavone's ear that Mick Foley was winning the title and told him to say that, put a lot of butts in seats. You know, there's something I've been wanting to say to you for a long time, and it's about time I got it off my chest. I got right in his face, and I went, thank you.
Pretty much.
That
I mean, you
made me a bigger star overnight, you know. So, without those guys giving away the finish, there's no 500,000 fans simultaneously flipping channels. And the strange thing is, I just talked about the ad lib, you know, the stuff after the match. Right after the win, there was a huge exodus to WCW because they had that huge main event at the Georgia Dome live. So they had something people wanted to see.
Right, right.
It's just that Schiavone and Tony and Eric kind of let people know that there might be something they'd like to see even more.
Absolutely.
And so, on the other channel. Yeah, it was a big, big night for us.
Absolutely. And, of course, your opponent that night, you guys launch into even before that night, you guys had already started a feud, you and The Rock, a feud that became a friendship. But everyone remembers, you know, obviously the I Quit match and all those chair shots. But, I mean, people forget that even before you won the title, there was the Survivor Series screw job. You kind of recreated the Bret Shawn thing with when he became the corporate champ. And you did the Super Bowl empty arena. You did the St. Valentine's Day massacre where you both knocked each other out simultaneously like Rocky II. I remember it all. And then, of course,
Rockin'. It was the Rocky II finish. Yeah, we did November, December, January, February, and then Mania, you know, five straight pay-per-views.
And then, of course, Rockin' Sock Connection, too. But, yeah, talk about working with...
The empty arena, and then we went on, you know, 8 months later, whatever it was, to team up and, and really create some good memories for people.
I think that Rock and Sock thing was still one of the most watched Raws ever, right? Which is so crazy because it was so outside the norm. How did you guys think, like, hey, go with us on this? I promise the viewers will watch. The This Is Your Life thing.
Well, I mean, credit goes to Vince Russo, actually, for coming up with the idea. But he knew that here's the basic structure, and then you guys have fun. And I remember they had the actors, local actors in North Carolina, like they're ready to run lines. They're like, okay, what do you want to do? And I brought Dwayne over and I went, I'll say something and Rock will come out and say something and then I'll call you out. I'll say something. And one of them looked at us and said, is this how you do it? And Rock was like, yeah, that's how we do it. So, you know, it turned out we went like 14 extra minutes on live prime time. TV. Mr. McMahon was seething that, you know, like a 12 or 14 minute segment went 26 or 28, and he thought it was an awful segment. But again, this is back in the days before, you know, Twitter and even texting, so the only thing we could figure out is that fans had to actually be calling their friends and going, you have to watch WWE. There was no other way to make, you know, to account for the huge increase in viewership.
What made working with The Rock so great? You guys were, I mean, I've heard him talk in hindsight, and even I think there was some like four-way tag match that you thought he would only come back for a big occasion, and the fact that he thought of you in that light.
Yeah, I didn't know. I mean, I knew that we'd had a great match together. I knew that we'd had great chemistry and you know, made people really, I get this comment from time to time, and it's just... It's beyond flattering when someone will go out of their way and go, like, I want you to know I was going through a really tough time. And they'll point to that pairing more than anything else as something that cheered them up, brought them around, gave them something to look forward to. But neither of us knew that what we were doing was anything special. Like, we talked about that years later. And I just, I don't know, I thought I never thought The Rock considered me to be on the level of some of those other opponents he had. And so when I got the call asking if I would, you know, what I thought about teaming up with The Rock in 2004, I said, well, that sounds great. But I'd seen it in writing. It said he would only come back for anything, something big.
Right.
I said, it sounds great to me, but I was told he would only come back for something big. And Brian Gewirtz, who now runs The Rock's production company, was like, yeah, Rock thinks this is big. And he does, you know. And then I would see things, you know, in interviews he did later on, and his own DVD that WWE did, where he talked so highly of me. And I didn't know it at the time. So it was really nice, especially given, you know, how his we might be talking about the next president of the United States, that he has a good, you know, thinks of me pretty highly.
That's got to feel great. I need to know about Mr. Sacco, because you've been doing Mandible Claw for a while, and it's a fascinating move, unique move in itself. But when did you get the idea? I know it was during the Austin McMahon bedpan segment, but which was hysterical. But when did you get the idea of, hey, I'm going to take the Mandible Claw and put a sock over it and pull it out of my pants?
You know, luckily, you know, most fans just think, hey, yeah, that's a disgusting sock that he puts in people's mouths. But it had been a nerve hold used as a finisher for
right.
2 years at that point. So there was some history. And we didn't know when I did the sock it was going to lead to anything beyond that day. So when Vince Russo came up to me the next night in Detroit, he's like, bro, you got the sock? I was like, I don't know. It turned out he's in my bag. You know, they're chanting for him. They got signs for him. bro, you got the sock, as if I couldn't just draw another one, you know. And we were on to something. So I think it was like the second night after that, I just thought, hey, I'm a guy known for, you know, this claw hold. Apparently people like me with a sock puppet. And we put the two together. It was like the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup of wrestling finishing holds.
Did you ever reuse the same sock, or did you do a new one each week?
Well, the first few weeks it was the same sock. And then, with the exception of Al Snow, I was quickly becoming the least popular guy in the dressing room. As long as Al was there, that first spot was kind of secure. But then I just realized, you know, not only is it proper respect, you know, to your opponents to have a clean sock, but it kind of gave me something to do after the match. You know, you throw the thing in the crowd and people would dive for it like it was a, you know, seventh
the Holy Grail
home run. Yeah,
that's so great. Well, we kind of talked about you and Taker and you and Rock, but there's one other program that an ongoing feud that I thought was arguably one of your best, and that was, of course, with Triple H. You convert back to Cactus Jack for that street fight at the Rumble, and then, of course, the what was at the time thought to be your retirement match, the Hell in the Cell there at No Way Out.
Yeah.
What was that street fight like? Because you guys brought out the barbed wire, the tacks. I mean, how awesome was it working with Triple H? Oh, and you went and did SummerSlam with him in Austin, too. But what did Triple H's rivalry mean to your career? Where does that sort of rank?
Yeah, it was really big for both of us because I had been really banged up, you know, before I was almost immobile. My knees were so bad. And then Triple H had great success with DX, but this was like his, you know, time to prove that he belonged at the top of the card as a singles wrestler. So it gave me a chance to go out the way that I wanted to go out and gave Triple H a chance to prove that he could be that, that he could, you know, carry the company on his shoulders. And so that's when things are working best, when both people come out ahead. So we had those two, you know, kind of legendary matches, and both of us look back on it like as if, you know, not as if, we look back on it as one of the best rivalries we were involved with.
Absolutely. And speaking of how you sort of went to Cactus Jack, you obviously did the three faces of Foley. What inspired you to kind of go back and forth between Cactus Jack, Mankind, Dude Love, and you know, Mankind always sort of had a screw loose anyway, so it kind of made sense that you do the split personality thing, I guess. But I just love how, like, and even with Mankind's mask, it's like, hey, I'm inspired by Hannibal Lecter, and we'll use sort of that scene where he plays that classical music after, you know, in Silence of the Lambs. But I loved how you reinvented all those characters with such thought like that. But, you know, why did you feel like you had to shift it up so much?
Well, you know, a lot of credit goes to Mr. McMahon. And the truth is, if Mr. McMahon thought I looked like a star going in and didn't think I looked sleazy, then I would have come in as Cactus Jack, and there never would have been an evolution of characters. But because he thought that covering up my face would be my only way into the company, and then later realized I had a an interesting backstory, not only as Cactus Jack, but that I'd had this character dude love, as a teenager. He really thought it would be that fans would love that that journey. And I remember him getting giving me a phone call like 8 a.m. Very thoughtful of him. It's 8 a.m. on a weekend. Like, hey, Bell, how'd you like to be Dude Love? And he liked seeing my dreams come true, and fans enjoyed it. So it was fun, and I get triple the royalties on action figures. So it works out. It worked out pretty good in the long run.
That's awesome. I know we're coming up against the clock, so final couple questions. But you mentioned your early days, and where you had that character. I remember seeing videos of you jumping off garages, doing the snooka splash that you had. I think you hitchhiked to Madison Square Garden, right?
Yeah, I did. I sure did.
Yeah, yeah. So I bring all this up because I remember reading your memoirs. I think you, if not the first, one of the first, and this was before the internet, but it was sort of that groundbreaking behind the scenes look. And you published several memoirs, and I just remember page turning, flipping that thing, and just, oh my God, sort of the inspiration from a young man, the boyhood dream has come true kind of a deal. But talk about sort of how influential you think those books were, not only padding your coffers, sir, but just peeling the curtain back before the internet took off.
And there was some concern about how honest I was in the book, and my thought was always, people are going to respect wrestling and WWE more when they're finished than they do when they begin. And I think that was almost universally the case. I respected people's intelligence. I didn't try to portray wrestling as something it wasn't, and I knew that the facts were often usually stranger than fiction. So hey, we didn't know what we had on our hands. I wrote it in 50 days in longhand, almost 200,000 words, and it just turned out I had a conversational style that people liked, and kind of opened the floodgates for wrestling books. So I guess in a sense, I can both take credit for some of the success and be the guy to blame for some of the bad ones. But I think another alarming thing, in a good way, is that so many wrestlers then realize, hey, I can actually write my own book. And
right.
I'm not knocking football, basketball, baseball, but I think it'd be very rare. At the time, it was thought to be just ludicrous that any athlete or performer would write their own book.
Right.
It's usually as told to or just done with a ghostwriter who does all the writing, 100% of the writing, and in some cases the actor, athlete, performer has very little to do with what actually comes out. So it was seen as being really strange, but there's got to be at least 10 wrestling books that have been actually written almost 100% with the help of an editor, of course. Otherwise my punctuation and then I fell in love with the semicolon to the point where the editor actually knew, like, all right, just leave some and make semicolons, even if they're not used correctly. just like seeing them out there.
That's his signature.
In one sense, it inspired people to go after their dreams, and inspired some of the other wrestlers to write their own books. And in my case, it open up doors for me to try different things. And even though I've failed at far more things than I've succeeded in, a couple big successes goes a long way. And here's the awkward, blatant segue into the 20 Years of Hell tour. I'll be trying things out every night, and some will fail, some will succeed. But, hopefully in the same way my career went, everything will be done with passion and a firm belief in what I'm doing.
Awesome. Yeah. So just wrapping it up full circle to the DC Improv show, the 20 Years of Hell tour. How exactly is it going to work? You're going to get up there, share some memories, then do like a 45-minute Q&A?
It won't. Anything that's done really well will appear to be effortless. Like, this will be something I really work on. It's not just, hey, let's talk Hell in a Cell. Like, I'm really working on it, trying to come up with the best show I can. I think we'll start with some memories, of DC, because I have a lot of history in DC, and then I'll do my very best to bring people, to make that night of the June 28th, 1998 come alive on stage. Then we open up the the floor to questions, and oftentimes the questions will lead to an answer that, you know, lead to a story that I hadn't even thought of in years.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, the Q&A is the highlight of the show. Like, if the sell part is good enough, that won't be the case. But the Q&As are always fun. Always fun. And I believe there's actually some VIP tickets left on sale. And I think there's going to be a couple people from WWE, the organization there, checking out the show with the idea of doing something down the line.
That's awesome. Well, before you go, could you give us a cheap pop of what you might sound like here in Washington, D.C.?
Oh, like, hey, it's great to be right here in Washington, D.C. And at least one congressman will be on hand. It's we're going to have the special assistant to Secretary of Defense, William Cohen, will be there. His office is filled with photos of him with world leaders and Mr. Sacco. Yeah, there'll be an interesting, eclectic group of people there. So there'll be a congressman from Washington, the state of Washington, assistant to the Secretary of Defense, and who knows who else may be on hand.
Awesome. Well, we really do appreciate you taking the time, Mick. Again, everybody, it's Thursday, April 12th at the DC Improv, the 20 Years of Hell Tour with Mick Foley. So I can't think of a better way to close it than just saying, have a nice day.
Have a nice day. RealMickFoley.com if you want to learn more about the show.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Have a nice day. Thanks.